Welcome to Recovery Cartel. Rich Jones's Recovery Cartel is part of the Mental Health News Radio Network, MHNRnetwork.com. We're sponsored by Faber Greenville, fabergreenville.org. Faber Greenville is changing the way we deliver recovery support services, the premier provider in the nation of a new and innovative way to work with individuals and families struggling with substance use disorders. Also, epreventions.com. ePreventions is a software platform, technology platform, reaching out to families, providing support to treatment centers as they deal with the baffling problem of addiction. Welcome aboard the cartel. Welcome to Recovery Cartel. This is Rich Jones. Just real quick before we get started with today's guest, I want to talk a little bit and make sure people understand where we're coming from on Recovery Cartel. Remember, Recovery Cartel, the goal is to try to give you new information, different type of guests, different type of thinking. You'll hear me talk a lot about the bubble, the industry bubble that exists, or the recovery bubble that exists where everybody thinks alike, everybody talks alike. You're not really allowed to have a divergent opinion or you're thought of as a troublemaker. We want to be the troublemaker. We want to be the people with the divergent opinion. We want to be the people that are saying the opposite of what everyone else is saying, not just for the sake of saying it, but because, you know, we believe that the old kind of tried and true business model, tried and true system, definitely the old thinking has proven itself to be ineffective, as proved by record-setting deaths, 70% rinse and repeat in private treatment centers, only 20% follow through after detox. Those type of numbers are abysmal. And what we want to do is we want to challenge that. It's not about any particular person or any particular program. It's just, look, at a certain point, you have to look around and say the ship is sinking. And so we better do something dramatic to save this thing. And so I don't really want to just be kind of hanging out on the deck of the Titanic while we go down. Titanic? Did I say that right?
Titanic.
All right. Well, there you heard from our guest today. So in that spirit, our guest, we're going to take a little bit of a different tack today. And we want to talk about family recovery. We want to emphasize the experience from the family's end. And again, even in that spirit, we don't want to kind of go through, and I don't want to bring in a family therapist so they can tell you the theory of what it's like to live through an addiction in the family. I'm going to bring in a person who went through it. And who better to talk about that than my wife, Melissa Jones. Melissa, say hi.
Hi, Rich. Thanks for having me.
So Melissa is a person who lived through, I guess, what you would call kind of a person's high functioning addiction. I still had a job. I still did things in the community. I coached sports teams, that kind of thing. It was one of those situations where on the surface it looked really good, but behind the scenes, she was dealing with the fallout from my addiction. I was addicted to alcohol and prescription pain pills. I was at the beginning of the opioid epidemic, I guess you could call it. And she had to negotiate that and all the nuances with that and all the fear and anxiety and stress associated with that. And what do you do with the kids and how do you handle this? And so we know that for every one person who has a substance use disorder, there are five family members who are directly impacted. So this is where we're going to start. This is where we're going to start on the Recovery Cartel. We're going to talk about what it's like to get through that and maybe what are some of the skills associated with that. Now, we have to establish a couple ground rules really, really quickly. Melissa already knows this, but I need the listeners to know that she knows this. I'm in charge on this show. What I say goes. I am the boss, man.
Okay, yeah, I just want to interrupt and just say pretty much you can just take a hike.
You can say what you
will. I'm going to say pretty much whatever I want.
You can say what you will, but if you start painting me in too bad of a light, I will interrupt, and I will also have it edited out. I run the editors. I pay the people that edit this show, so I am in charge, just so you're aware of that.
You and your ego.
Yes, me and my ego run this show. All right. So, all right, Melissa, let's just get this thing kicked off. And again, you're going to tell it in all seriousness. You tell your side of the story, your side of this experience. And all right, where did we meet?
Well, we met a few times. Initially, I was 11, so you can't seem to recall that incident.
All right, you don't have to go back that far. When did we meet? Whenever you fell in love and I swept you off your feet and it was the beginning of paradise.
Right,
when did
that
happen?
That's how it went. Well, as I recall, I was on my way out of the country for a year. You became friends with my brother, and when I came back, miraculously, you were madly in love with me. I could think of nothing else.
I think that's a bit of revisionist history. So I knew your brother. Your brother and I had common interests. How should I put this? We had common recreational interests, and I met you through him. And, you know, you have your version of the story. I have my version of the story. But at some point in time, we get together. So we've been together for 25 years married, 4 years dating. So that's 29 years of absolute bliss. Am I getting that right?
Yep. It's absolute bliss.
Absolute bliss. 29 years. So whenever we first got together and we started hanging out and stuff like that, did you ever have any consideration of how much a person should party or what, like, did anybody ever give you any education around drinking? And
when we first dated, we first started dating, it was 1989. Most of the people that I knew partied. Most of the people that I knew drank a little, maybe smoked a little weed. Very few people I knew did anything beyond that. So that was pretty normal.
So the fact that I was messing around with that stuff, hanging with your brother, doing those things, that was, there were no red flags that went off. You just sort of thought that it was kind of normal.
I knew very few people that didn't partake of that from time to time. I didn't have any concerns because of that.
You know, so one of the things that we're going to do through this interview is kind of use this information to try to be instructive and try to talk to our audience about how to handle these issues as we go forward. So this is something right off the bat that I want to talk about. You know, if you have kids and those type of things, if you have daughters, you know, talk to them about who they're dating. And you're not going to get your kids, you're not going to get your daughters to follow your directions just out of hand. You're not going to say your daughters date a certain type of guy. They're not going to follow that. But you just want to share the information.
And sons.
My bad. Okay. Daughters and sons. Kids. Don't interrupt me like that again. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that we've established that. At any rate, you just want to kind of like give them the information. They need to know what path they're walking down. And it isn't, don't do it in a way where it's punitive and you say, like, if you're with this person, then that's unacceptable. Give them the information. The information early on that Melissa could have benefited from would have been something about, you know, how many people do use and, you know, does everybody drink? Does everybody use? Could it wind up in a bad space? So that's just on a side note. But at any rate, we get together, you know, I'm doing my thing. It probably gets out of hand every once in a while, but it really doesn't cause any problems because you're just sort of like, this is what people do.
And when you bring that up, it reminds me of an incident that involved alcohol that was concerning. And my mother didn't raise any concerns about what we were doing together and, you know, why I actually involved me drinking. And she didn't raise any concerns. There was never a conversation about what I was doing with Rich or where we were going and maybe some questions about where we were going, but there were no red flags. I didn't get any adult warnings.
Yeah, we don't talk about this issue. We really don't talk about alcohol or drugs. We usually don't talk about it until it's too late. We kind of have an approach where don't touch it at all until they hit bottom, and then we'll put them in a drug and alcohol clinic and we'll make them call themselves an alcoholic or a drug addict. But anything in between, we don't really talk about. So what we're trying to say is talk about it. Just get it out there. You don't have to solve the problem. You don't have to shut your kids down. You don't have to deny them access to every other kid in the neighborhood or anything like that. It's nothing crazy like that. It's just talk about the issue of substance use. So we get together, that kind of thing. I'm sure, you know, there were other incidents where maybe drinking went over the top or using went over the top. But can you recall it at any point in time or at what point in time when you actually started to witness consequences related to my use and you started to say to yourself, this might not be a good idea?
Yes, drinking wasn't really that interesting to me. That wasn't something that I was entertained by very much. There were occasions where it became a source of argument for us. What, I wanted to do
how,
other
how things. How deep into the relationship was that?
Well, the first year was pretty much a good year overall. But there were times during that first year where it was a source of argument, times when you came over to see me late, didn't show up, chose to do things with your friends, i.e. party and use drugs instead of spending time with me.
Yeah, that's interesting. Choose to do things with your friends. I even recall that, hey, I want to go out with my friends was actually a euphemism for I want to go out and get hammered. It's interesting. You couch it in terms when we're in active addiction and we're doing our things. We couch it in terms of other activities, but really it's all about drinking. So I want to go to the football game. I got to go to the football game. I got to watch the football game. But it's really about I want to go get hammered. We just know that if we say to our loved ones, hey, I want to go get hammered, that's not going to go over so well. So you'll hear things like, I got to go spend time with my friends, or I got to go to hunting camp, or I got to go to see the Steelers play this weekend. And really it's all about the party. So you started to notice that relatively early in our relationship, a year or two in.
Yes.
Okay. Did you try to change anything? Did you try to reel me in? Do you recall trying to put up any boundaries even at that point?
Yeah, pretty early on, I decided like, hey, you know, you shouldn't be smoking weed. You don't need to do that. And I would get angry if you did or if you lied about it. So right off the bat, the line started and I'm starting to kind of make threats and not really following through on them either.
So this is very important. 2 years into our relationship, and I don't know if I had crossed the line into addiction at that point. I don't know. It could have just been heavy use. It could have just been partying at that point. But already we were getting into this pattern of threats around boundaries, but really no follow through on boundaries. There was this kind of crisis oriented nature to our relationship where I would do something over the top and I'd apologize and you'd be saying, don't do that again. Don't do that again. And it would just become repetitive. How about, did it escalate from there? And if so, how long did it take till it got to another level? I recall some things. I do recall at one point in time, you did kind of walk the other way.
Yeah, after about 2 years breakup, going back and forth, I was like, okay, this isn't going in the direction I want. I was at college. I chose to spend my time with other people. I was done. And so we broke up for about a year at that point.
So that was probably the first time where there was a follow through, and it was related to substances. There's no question about it. It wasn't necessarily the only thing that was going on. And again, I want to go on the record that it's absolutely statistically impossible that every problem in our relationship was my fault. That's not the case whatsoever. The
jury's still out.
But substances played a big role in that. It was putting a wedge between the relationship or within the relationship. It was putting a wedge between us.
Yeah, it was the number one reason for the breakup. There were little reasons, but that was the dominant issue.
But I don't remember you saying anything along the lines or anything close to, you have to quit drinking, you have to quit using if we're going to be together. I don't remember that clear of a conversation.
Well, I don't know that I was ever to the point where I felt you need to quit. I know the drinking, that to me was normal. The pot, I'm sure I said many times, you need to quit. And you always framed it up as needing to spend time with your friends. So I remember one night I was sick and you wanted to go out with your friends. And I said, if you go, we're over. And you went. And so that
I left you home sick.
Yeah. Actually.
I find that hard to believe. I find somebody with my level of compassion, that's hard to believe that I would have done that. But again, the idea, don't look at me like that. The idea that I got to go out with my friends. This is an important thing. This is how the denial system or the psychological process around addiction works. We don't look directly at the issue. So we always couch it in other terms. I have to go out with my friends, or I'm so stressed out from work that I just need to go out after work and blow some steam off.
Right. And what that does to the partner, the spouse, makes you feel like you're a bad person. Like, I'm so petty. I'm so jealous. He just wants to spend time with his friends. And instead of like, no, he wants to go use.
Right. And if we took away all the manipulation and all the smoke and mirrors, the direct conversation would have been, hey, Melissa, I want to go out and get high and get drunk. You can see that that's not going to go over as well as, hey, Melissa, I want to go out and spend time with my friends. Those friends, quote unquote, that I was spending time with then, I haven't talked to any of them for 20 some years. They were good guys and stuff like that. And I liked them. And it was genuine in the sense that when we got together, we had fun, but they weren't lifelong friends or the type of situation where if I didn't have them in my life, I was going to suffer. So I hope you can see that's the diabolical nature and the baffling nature of addiction and how it seeps in and how it's in our relationship. It started very early. So we start to get into this pattern and I start to learn subconsciously how to frame this stuff and how to work this stuff so that I'm able to maintain this relationship with a person that I loved and also kind of engage in these behaviors that she doesn't approve of that really, like, no, at that time, now you got to remember that was back in the day when marijuana was still a drug. I mean, marijuana was thought of as a big deal back then. So, you know, smoking weed you weren't really looked upon favorably. It wasn't something that was put on a pedestal like it is today. Today, marijuana is not a problem at all. So I hope you can understand the context for this. This is the late 80s, whenever all this is going down. All right. So we go through that. Some problems start to emerge. You sort of put a boundary up around that.
When you said about, you know, the person that you love, that there's some truth to that because there was real love there, even in spite of all those issues and the troubles. You really did love me, and I knew that. And that's what got us back together after about a year being apart. And I loved you. So
that, in my incredibly stunning good looks.
Yes,
my
charisma, warm,
personality,
engaging nature.
There was a, you know, I'm sure you looked at the situation. You were able to judge it. There was a lot of potential there, and there was kind of like a high-end ceiling on the other end.
Right.
It wasn't just.
You gave me a list of all your good qualities.
Yes.
So in case I missed any.
Yes, and all those have proven to be accurate, right?
Absolutely.
Admit it. It's all
of
true.
Of course.
Okay, so we get back together and then things get kind of serious, right? Because quickly thereafter, you know, we're pregnant with Nathan, right? And so at a certain point in time, the relationship goes to another level. We get married. I get a career, that kind of thing. We start to settle down to have the American dream. And this was very, very early on. So I took a job outside of Philadelphia in the Allentown area. What was that like? So that had to be a little bit different for you, because now it wasn't just I was dating this dude. You know, we were trying to set up a life together.
That was a scary time. I know the wedding was on again, off again. I remember throwing that ring about 25 times. It lost its kind of impact after the first three times.
Yeah. You can't throw, just on a side note, you can't throw your wedding ring at somebody over and over again and expect it to have impact.
I always made sure I knew where it went too, so I could go get it.
Yeah. So that was obviously a very stressful, very tenuous period of time. You know, living in a foreign city, if you will, where we didn't know anyone. But I know
expecting a baby is not very compatible with somebody who has a substance abuse issue, because you can't really go out with them. So,
well, let's talk about that for a minute. Did you know at that time, had you labeled it as a substance abuse problem in your mind? Had you labeled it?
No, I was nowhere close to considering that a substance abuse issue at that time.
It's not even politically correct anymore to call it a substance abuse issue. We're supposed to call it substance use disorder.
Oh,
yes.
My bad.
And it really, none of that means anything. People have spent a bunch of time talking about that. And again, that feeds into that stuff that I just can't stand. It's like, that's not what we need in our world. We need action. We need people in the street. All right, that's a side note. Let's not go off on that. All right. So you're not even labeling it. You're sort of still going through the process. I can look back and I can tell you at that point in time, that's when I'm getting real close to crossing that line into addiction. I can reflect on my life now. At the time, I didn't know it, but that was probably when it really started to take on a different tone. I can remember countless nights where I would go out to blow off some steam with the guys from work, and I would be out way too late, way longer than I intended. Other substances would come into the picture. And again, at the time, I didn't know what I was going through, but I was definitely taking it to another level. Did you start to notice that?
Yeah.
Did it get more serious?
Yeah, it was a very lonely time for me. I was in a new town and expecting a baby. You were gone. You were working a lot. You always had a really good work ethic. That anybody who knows you will know that. So you were working a lot, but you were also partying a lot. So I was very lonely. And that's, I think, the beginning of when I sensed that there's a wall. And anyone who's been in a relationship with someone in addiction will know that wall. You're only ever going to get so close to that person. And the wall was bigger and smaller at various times, depending on where you were.
Let's talk about that issue of the work ethic. And I want to tell you something. This is definitely something to think about. One of the things that I did was I held on to work, and I was going to work, and I was going to work extra hours, and I was going to work extra hard, and I was going to be successful. And that almost fueled my using. And I can tell you that is one of the most common things. So when you're looking at the situation, whether or not the person has a job and whether or not the person works, that has nothing to do with whether or not it's a substance use disorder. Here's the thing. We have this caricature in our mind of the person who has an alcohol problem or a drug problem, and that they're some kind of loser and they're living under the bridge and they can't provide for their family. Don't feed into that. Don't feed into that. Most of us are incredibly resourceful and very, very hard workers. We're not liars, cheaters, and thieves, as we've been conditioned to call ourselves.
I think anybody that knew you would describe you as a fun, energetic person, and we're happy to have you around.
Yes. Well, to this day, that's how most people describe me, okay? As a fun, energetic person who they love to have around.
I had moments where I didn't describe you as that.
Okay, so then things continue to, you know, we go down that path and things start to escalate. Can you recall the first time you did start to label this thing? At some point in time, you must have the word alcoholic must have started to enter your head. At some point in time.
Right. After a third child, probably between our second. Well, it was before that. The incidents and probably the types of substances that you were using began to change, and they started to get to be more serious.
Yeah. So the years click by, you know, crisis to crisis, situation to situation. And then Melissa makes a really good point. Then the substances start to creep up. And just so everyone understands how my story went down, in 1999, I was in a car accident and I started to get opioid-based painkillers given to me hand over fist.
Anyway, right. I knew when that accident happened, and anybody who's been in a relationship with someone in addiction, we all have that moment like, here we go. And I knew things were going to get bad at that point. And they did.
Yeah, I can remember when we got that prescription filled, that first prescription, it was Darvocet, and the pills were pink. I remember that. And I took four right off the bat, and I remember you saying, this isn't good. And you sort of had
that. How many were you prescribed?
You're supposed to. I was supposed to take one every 4 hours. I was taking four every 1 hour. and that was just, I read the bottle wrong.
I guess.
So at any rate, you know, I abused these things right off the jump. And I got them. This is way before all the awareness around the opioid epidemic, way before any prescription monitoring program. I never had anyone say anything to me about that. I just got these things given to me like Tic Tacs.
There were incidents before that, too. There was a few incidents where involving cocaine. There were Ritalin, I think.
Now, what you've just done is the public knows that I have used cocaine before. So when I was going to run for president in 2020, and now the public knows I did cocaine. So my campaign is probably ended because of that.
That's not going to be an issue anymore. Those days are over.
Oh, okay.
You're good to go.
Okay, I'm good to go. That skeleton is now out of the closet.
Yeah.
We'll get our press secretary on that and see if we can spin that in any kind of way. All right. So things get worse. Really, really bizarre. I definitely cross the line, take it to another level. What was it like then? So if you think of that, you know, toward the end, it seems, and I've heard you talk about this before, it went from bad to worse in terms of living with me, right? It was really, really hard to deal with.
Right. After our first child, I saw the direction that you were going in, and that wasn't for me. I wanted to set up camp, have a family, do family type things. Smoking weed wasn't going to cut it for me. I didn't want any part of it. I didn't want it around me. So I had been going in a different direction at this point for several years. You were still trying to find ways to hold on to that life. And I would catch you sneaking things here and there. So it was a constant source of conflict every time I found something. I remember one time doing the laundry and finding a little seed of marijuana in the pocket of your pants. Like, I got good. That's the other thing. My skills got very good.
You've talked before, I've heard you say before, about you kind of become like a private investigator.
Yeah. And I mean, unfortunately for my adult and young adult children, very difficult for them to pull anything over on me because I was well trained.
So you're looking around for things, you're searching for things. What's that like to be living with somebody who you're kind of basically watching all the time and trying to figure out what's going on with them? Is that, talk about what that was like.
Well, you're on edge all the time. You don't know what you're going to find. You don't know when you're going to come around a corner and see something. The hardest is when you don't expect it. Sometimes you know there's something there and you're digging and you're hunting. And those are actually better than when you're not expecting it. But you eventually you stop not expecting it, and you become that private detective always looking for evidence and clues. And
why are you looking for evidence? What's the dynamic?
Well, then you
there?
Turn into the judge and the jury. You know, then you go after them and give them a guilty verdict. And there was no compassion for addicts in those days. It was, you're doing this because you don't love me. You don't care about a relationship. There was no, you can't help it. You're sick. Not really.
So we know now about the process of addiction. We have brain scans. We can show people literally pictures of what an addictive brain looks like. Back then, there wasn't a lot of education around the whole process with the deficiency of dopamine and how dopamine is depleted and the drug-seeking behaviors take over and the alcohol-seeking behavior takes over. Would that have made a difference?
I think it might have. It might have helped to some extent, you know, and I know I'm jumping around here. You asked me, like, what it was like, when did I know that you had a problem? Those things all heightened my sense of concern and fear. There was so much fear because I did start to ask myself, is he an alcoholic? And if you were, it was going to be terrifying. It was a death sentence. So I was afraid of a positive result on that. But not calling it addiction or alcoholism didn't change the fact that the beer cans were hitting the recycling bin at night while I was laying there counting them.
So you laid in bed at night counting the number of cans that hit the recycling bin to try to quantify the depth of my problem.
Right. I remember sneaking out the kitchen door one time, going down the back stairs and peeking in the bathroom window to see if there was anything nefarious going on in there. Like, I thought you might be hiding and using some kind of substance in there. So I became a different person for sure. So still, though, didn't want to call it addiction, didn't know what it was, but if it was addiction, it was going to be bad.
Yeah, so it starts to literally seep out of the individual who has the addiction into all the family members. Their behaviors start to change. They become addicted to the person. That's where the term codependency comes from. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the term codependency, but it works. You know, you become dependent on that person and seeking out information regarding their addiction, trying to manage their addiction, trying to control their addiction, trying to find out what's going on becomes almost like a full-time job.
Right.
And then that starts to affect you as an individual in your life? I'm sure it affects your health, your mental health, just the way you handle the kids. Parenting is a big deal at that point.
By about 10 years, I reached a point where I knew there's a problem. I didn't care anymore what that meant. I didn't care whether or not you agreed. I remember going to you and saying, you have a problem. I don't care what you think, but I know you do. And just laying it on the table, didn't really matter whether you agree with me. I wasn't even looking for a response. It was almost like, here it is.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot. We talk about a process that we believe people go through the family, from crisis to stabilization to the stage that you're talking about of acceptance. And acceptance in the sense not that you think it's okay, but that you're basically able to resign yourself to this is what we're dealing with. And right. That happened for you. Did any certain thing happen to get you there? Or do you feel like it's just a matter of time that a person will get there?
Your problem had escalated to the point where you were never really okay. That's the thing. Like early on, there were a lot of times when you were okay, but the disease was gaining in severity. And you were laying in bed a lot. There were sleep problems. You were just never okay. And I spent a lot of time just trying to get you to be okay so that we could do our family. And it was exhausting.
You were managing the situation and you got tired of managing the situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's the point out there. If you're a family member dealing with it, you got to honor yourself through that process. And you got to understand that there's not a one size fits all solution for this. We know people will be told to practice tough love. I don't even think there is such a thing as tough love. It's just love. It's the appropriate expression of love. And you don't have to come into this immediately, and you don't have to feel judged if you're not ready to set those boundaries. My wife went through a process where it ended with her being ready to set those boundaries. We believe that if you learn about it along the way and you learn about addiction, and you learn about recovery, and you learn about what your options are, that you'll come to that conclusion sooner. But you can't feel judged and you can't feel like this is a one size fits all solution. So at a certain point, Melissa, becomes aware that this is an issue, comes in and basically says, like, look, dude, you got a problem. What happened from there? Did you move into like kind of an action zone at that point? What was your plan from that point forward?
I made a decision to stay in the relationship for the well-being of my kids, but I was unable to follow through with that at that point because the relationship became impossible. You went from being the so-called happy drunk to being, I don't know what the name is.
To being miserable. That's what happens with addiction. It goes from like happy times and happy drunk and just boys will be boys, good times. And I'm telling you, you descend into this depth where you're miserable all the time, whether you have the drug or not. It's just absolute misery. And that's
right,
what you were saying.
And I think the pills escalated the speed of that
process. Oh, for sure. Yep.
But it was impossible to stay in the relationship. So I said, go. We were having a fight one night and I said, just leave.
And what happened?
You left.
Oh, where did I go?
Well,
my mom's house, probably.
Yeah, I called her and told her that you were coming there. And she said, well, I did my time. I don't want them.
That's great. Being with me at that point in time was like being in prison. My mom was saying I did my time. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end in terms of the addiction. That was when everything started to hit the fan. That wasn't my precise clean date or anything like that, but that was definitely toward the end, right?
Right. That was pretty close. One of the conditions for you, because you wanted to come back, especially since you weren't really that welcome there. I guess she didn't really let you in that night.
But hold on a second. So before you get into coming back and everything that happened, then how did you go from being unable to do that kind of thing to being able to do that kind of thing? What happened? What kind of process did you have to go in your mind where you were finally able to say, get the hell out?
Well, I was a stay-at-home mom and I had no income and I had always been worried about what I would do if I had to support my kids and I didn't want to go and work and not be there for them. So I felt very conflicted about that. So for me, that meant I might have to go and be on welfare and live in the projects. And that was a terrifying thought. But at that point, it would have been more peaceful and tranquil than living in that situation.
Okay, boom. That's the thing. So do you see that there's usually a fear? There's usually a specific fear. And sometimes it's a big time fear. Like I know when I talk to parents a lot, the fear is that my child's going to die. In this case, Melissa was able to tap into this fear of how am I going to take care of the kids and how are we going to be provided for? Once you can face that fear, if you can face that fear, then typically you're able to move into a more active recovery process as a family member. If the fear controls you, if the what ifs control you, you're highly likely to not make a move. You're kind of going to be stuck in this pattern, even if it's a destructive pattern, because you're afraid to take that step because it's just too much. I can't make this move. I can't live in the projects with my kids. But it got so bad that you were able to look at that and you were able to say, whatever, I'll take that over this.
Yeah, I became at peace with whatever possibilities lay ahead. That there was no peace in that living situation anymore.
A couple other questions. Were you seeking any information along the way? Were you talking to anyone?
I had made a couple phone calls to 1-800 services over the years.
What was it, like 1-800, my husband's an addict? Like, what the hell is a 1-800 number?
I think it was in the phone book. Internet was new at that time, but there were things online that you could go and get some information. There wasn't really interactive communication online, so you could go and get a phone number.
So you had talked to somebody. This is another point, you know, I'll talk about your experience. Be careful who you call and where you get your information. Obviously, today you have a lot more access. You can Google information. But I'm telling you, there are so many what I would call like instant experts out there who really don't know what they're talking about. And they're going to give you a bunch of information. And if you call about your loved one, they're basically, their main objective is to get them into their treatment program. So they're not going to give you good information. So be careful as a family member where you get your feedback and where you get your education and where you get your advice. There are so many clowns out there, it blows my mind. But at any rate,
I think these were probably a little bit more wholesome times when everybody wasn't out to try to make a buck on the addict. But they told me, first of all, I said, how do I know if he's an addict? And they said, well, if you're concerned and you're calling here, there's an indication that there's a problem.
That was a pretty good answer. That's a pretty standard answer.
Right. So it still didn't really solve my dilemma or did give me the definitive answer that I was looking for. And I said, well, you know, should I leave him? How do I know when I should leave him? And they said, you'll know when you're ready. So at that time, I wasn't ready. It felt good to hear that because I wasn't being pushed to do anything I wasn't ready to do.
That's an amazing, you got really lucky when you called that person. If you made a phone call like that today, they would twist you and bully you into trying to get that person into treatment. Obviously, not every single person would, but man, that was a really good answer that that person gave you. You'll be ready whenever you know.
What did bring me some comfort and some peace, and things at that time weren't as bad as they got. Those words stayed with me throughout the duration. And when I was ready, I knew and I understood what she meant. Until then, I didn't really know what she meant. But when I was ready, I knew.
And that's when you became a ninja boundary center, a boundary setting ninja. And you were just you put the hammer down. And that was the beginning of the recovery process. And I'm not going to go into great detail around my recovery, but one thing led to another. And I followed through and I started attending meetings and I did what I needed to do. And I've been in recovery ever since. That's 16 years ago. Talk about what it was like in early recovery. How did you deal with, for example, me going to all these meetings?
That was hard. Well, we had moved to a new city again. We sold our house where we were living and moved to a new city. And so once again, I was feeling isolated, and then you were gone every night at meetings, and that was hard. And I remember going and talking to, I was angry, first of all, because a lot of the truth was coming out, and I felt like bitter over the wrongs and the injustice that had been done to me. So I was still kind of working on healing, and I remember the clergy had told me, well, what if he had cancer? Would you begrudge him of going to his cancer treatments? Which still angered me.
So let me paraphrase. Like she's being real politically. She was pissed that I was spending all these nights at these 12-step meetings and things like that, and she was still home with the kids and stuff. And
but you had to go, because if you weren't going, then I would have also been angry. So you were kind of in a no-win situation there.
It's tough, man. So and we get that. And if you're in addiction and you're in early recovery and you're dealing with this, understand what the family's going through. And if you're the family, try to have compassion toward the person. We're damned if we do, damned if we don't. We got to be in these meetings and stuff like
that. Well, and I wanted you to go to the meeting. If you wouldn't have gone, I'd have been like, what's going on here? But I didn't enjoy being home alone every night. And I still had three young kids.
And what I remember was you were just pissed. Like I would literally say to the guys, a lot of the guys I was hanging out with at that time, that if I'm not at a meeting tomorrow night, send somebody over to my house. I'm probably dead. My wife probably killed me in my sleep.
Yeah, I was
Why
bitter.
Why were you so angry?
I was bitter. It was all the times that I had apologized and felt like I'd been cheated. You know, forgiveness may not have been one of my strong points. So I was bitter. And I stayed that way until I couldn't stand it anymore.
Yeah, you stayed that way for a while. But let's tap into that for a minute and understand if you're out there.
I was supportive in other ways, though. I didn't drink. I was very, very supportive, but I was angry. That was it. I was supportive in every physical, practical way that I could.
But at a certain point, the anger started to actually destroy you.
Yeah.
So my point with this would be that the anger is natural, and you have to, I guess I'm talking to couples out there. If you're going through this, you got to understand that it is actually a healing process, and there's no way that this is going to happen quickly. The spouse that wasn't in addiction is going to go through a naturally occurring period of anger. The person who's in recovery, though, you have to understand that it's not 100% your fault. There's all kinds of different dynamics, and eventually this will smooth out, but it doesn't happen in the first week. It's not as if you enter into recovery, or here's a better way to say it. It's not like as if rehab fixes this. Rehab really isn't even recovery. It's just a start to the process. So you got to give each other space and you got to give each other time. But then eventually as time goes by,
the family doesn't get much support either. And I think that's something that I would love to see change.
Well, what about what I'm doing? I'm supporting the hell out of the family.
That's one type of support. But if you had been diagnosed with cancer, people would have been showing up at my house with casseroles. My family would have been embraced. We would have been welcome and not alone. So I remember looking for books. It was hard to even find books at that time for families of people in recovery. And it was very isolating. It wasn't something I could talk to people about.
So I
would love to see that happen someday. I would love for the family members to be enveloped with the kind of care that the family of a cancer patient gets.
Yeah. So if you're diagnosed with a physical disease, if you're diagnosed with cancer, people come over, they comfort you. If you're diagnosed with addiction, people shun you. And the stigma is still alive and well. I thought you were saying we need programs for the family. And I was going to say, hold up a second. I got that thing on lockdown.
Right.
How dare you? How dare you call out the fact that we don't have programs for the family? We are not. Family recovery. I am the family guy. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way. All right, so recovery comes into the picture, and I've been in recovery ever since. Did you seek any kind of support for yourself at one point?
No, I don't know.
Didn't you go to, you went to Al-Anon?
I went a couple of times to Al-Anon, but early on, I was very angry, and everyone would go around the room and they would finish whatever they were saying with something like, but I'm glad because it's what brought me to Al-Anon. And I wasn't glad and I didn't want to say that and I didn't want to hear it. And there were times when you would suggest over the years after that or in the first couple of years, you know, maybe you should try Al-Anon. And just hearing that made me mad because I wasn't the person that created this disease. I wasn't the person that In my mind, it was just still barely a disease.
Okay, hold on a second.
Many years to get my mind wrapped around.
You're tapping. Hold up. Remember, when I say hold up, you have to hold up. Remember, I am in charge. All right. So, how do you say it to somebody? So, everything you're saying right there, I've heard from a lot of family members. You know, I don't want to be told that I'm sick. I don't want to be told that I'm the problem. They're the ones that was going. How do you suggest we talk to family members to get them to come to support groups? Because that dynamic that you're expressing right there is very, very real. What could have somebody said that would bring you in a little bit quicker?
Well, it would have been nice maybe if there were some options other than just Al-Anon.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and I did go to Al-Anon eventually after about 9 years of trying to make all my problems be the result of your addiction. It got difficult. I had to get very creative and it got tiresome. But I did go and I did get help and I did feel better. So I don't want to say that Al-Anon doesn't do that, but early on, I think, you know, early on in the addiction process with the family, we want answers. And when you go to Al-Anon, you're going to find out how to change yourself. You're not going to get answers on how to, if you have someone still in addiction, they're not going to tell you, you know, how to get them not to drive your car into a tree with your kids in it.
Right.
So that's the frustrating part.
We've noticed that. And that's one of the things that, you know, we've developed a family program that we feel like is pretty unique. It's very focused on the practical aspect of addiction. We don't force you to work on yourself until you're ready to work on yourself. In the meantime, we will give you answers to questions. How do I handle my husband driving my kids?
Right. Aside from Favor, which wasn't around, obviously didn't exist at that time, there isn't really anybody telling you how to navigate the symptoms of addiction that are destroying your life, your finances. So you need practical answers when you're dealing with somebody new or still in addiction. And that's where Al-Anon kind of maybe lets people fall through the cracks because you're in a combat zone and you need practical answers and solutions. And
right.
not really like, how do I change myself? Because you're not really ready for that yet.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I have developed the fivefold family recovery process because of that. I've listened to you over the years. You don't want to be told fix yourself or work on yourself whenever you're actually preoccupied with your loved one, because it's a real deal issue. You really want to know, like, how do I handle these situations? And maybe there are situations to be fixed. So that's why we talk about crisis, stabilization, acceptance, family recovery initiation, and family recovery integration. And that's our proprietary fivefold model that I have developed, because I'm a borderline genius, Melissa.
That's fantastic. Yes. I'd like to learn more about this. I don't really know a whole lot about this.
Okay, we'll talk about that later. But I want you to know we hear you. We hear you, and we hear what you're saying, and that sentiment is echoed by a lot of folks dealing with this issue. If you walk into a family group and you're in the middle of the war, in your words, it's a war zone with the person, and you're told just work on yourself, a lot of times it doesn't resonate. A lot of times it just doesn't make any sense. And then those folks never come back to a group again, because, you know, people are going to go get information other places. People are going to, and they're really just going to vote with their feet. They're going to walk away and you're never going to see them.
Right. Again. And so, Al-Anon is good for long-term healing. And it really did do that for me. I took some time. You have to find the right group sometime. I had a really wonderful group in Pennsylvania that you could go in there and talk about the silly thing that you did not fit in with the 12 steps and how absolutely ridiculous it was. And everybody would embrace you, but not all groups were the same. You know, everybody was talking about how perfectly they were living Al-Anon and how great their life was doing. I found those to be not quite as helpful.
No, there's a wide variety of groups out there. That's right. The other thing. And if you're in addiction too, and you're listening to this, understand that there's a wide variety of groups out there, and they're not all created equal. And some of them will work for you and resonate, and others will be repulsive. I've gone to thousands and thousands and thousands of meetings of 12-step and other type of support groups, and there are some that I can't even believe. Like, I was in the room.
Thousands, that's a lot.
Certainly, I've been in this thing for 16 years. Right. Think about it.
No, I don't know.
Are you challenging the idea
it's
that...
Big fish, Rich.
That's thousands. Do the math. Get your little calculator out and do the math on how many... All right, I'll freaking prove it to you.
All right, whatever.
All right. So anyway, now that we've established all that, so now we get into recovery and things are pretty stable. And I wanted to touch on a couple other things real quick. You know, you said early on that you didn't really drink because you wanted to support my recovery, but that changed. It's not like you drink a lot, but we can go out and you can have a glass of wine. So I want people out there to know that how early recovery is may not be the way it is forever, right? I mean, you can change, and you're allowed to drink if you choose to.
And I don't know that you ever told me that I couldn't. I just didn't. I had been shell-shocked because there was a time in our relationship when the only way to get close to you, and I remember making that decision, is that if I was going to connect with you, I was going to have to drink too. And so on the weekends, I would have a couple glasses of wine, but I just didn't want any part of anything at that point.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to kind of like touch base, how do you, and again, say whatever is truly on your mind, but how do you, having gone through all that and kind of coming out the other side, are you glad you stuck around? What's it like now?
Yeah, I have said this before, and I'm sure that I hate to say it to you because then the ego is bigger. But having known you before and during and after addiction, I would definitely say that the person that you became after your addiction is the person that I would choose to be with. And I think when we hear about other people with other diseases, other life-threatening diseases, we tout them as heroes when they survive, as survivors. And I think the same is true for people who are in addiction and even people who are still fighting addiction. They deserve to be commended. If they've been in a rehab 26 times and they're going into rehab again, I commend that. I commend them for not giving up. But the person that you became as a result of your addiction is nothing short of heroic. And that's true for any recovering addict.
Well said. Well said. That was, man, I must really, really rub off on you spending this much time.
Unfortunately, it's not just you.
So there's this thing, this idea, this concept of the power of recovery. And the power of recovery really says that in addiction, we fall way below our potential, but in recovery, we exceed our potential. And I think that that's the case in my life, and that's the case in so many people's lives. And it's really good to hear you say that. I also wanted to kind of get your take on, we have kids, we have even some young adult children that are right in the middle of the world when all this is going on.
The stakes are so much higher now. You know, when we were young, your addiction took several years to escalate to the point where it was getting dangerous. And I don't think kids have the luxury. And kids are the same as they were 30, 40 years ago. Kids have always been, you know, willing to take those little risks and wanting to have a little fun. But this group, this generation, doesn't have the luxury of messing around with that, because one wrong move and they're in deep trouble. They're either heavily addicted or they're dead.
So the thing about it is talk. We got to be talking to our kids about these pills, and we got to be educating our kids on carfentanil and fentanyl, and the wiggle room that used to be around in terms of experimentation with things is no longer there. First of all, marijuana is not even a drug anymore, and we can wring our hands about that and we can lament that situation, but they've won that argument. They've successfully marketed marijuana as a benign, non-threatening substance. So our kids are going to be more likely to smoke marijuana. Perceived risk is way down. Also, these pills and these fake counterfeit pills and the idea that we live in a pill culture where, oh my goodness, the other day I read that the CDC has, there are 30,000 two-year-olds on ADHD medication. So what the hell? No wonder kids take pills. We've set them up for taking pills. And so we have got to educate our kids on the dangers of these substances. And we got to be really, really forthright with what we're faced with. I had a public official who will go nameless said that we really shouldn't talk. Don't talk about the opioid epidemic. We don't want to frighten people. It's not something we want to talk about. I was stunned when that person said it. I mean, institutional denial, the idea that this thing is going to go away on its own. They've compared the opioid epidemic to the crack epidemic. They're two completely different things.
I was talking to a young person and they said that everybody knows somebody who's overdosed at this point. So like, who does he think he's going to fool? Like, not talking about it doesn't, everybody knows about it anyway.
I think the thing is that a lot of these folks, unfortunately, aren't thinking really deeply about it. It's business as usual. Let's grind it out. And they literally think that the epidemic will go away on its own. And even though nationwide experts are predicting 650,000 deaths over the next decade. But I don't want to go off on that too much. So life has kind of, we've ridden off into the sunset.
Right. So now it's our kids. How do we keep the kids? How do we keep the next generation? And that's a hard question to answer. My kids, we pretty much badgered them to death, and I don't know that that's the best way. I don't think we really have a good way to guarantee. There's no guarantees.
No, it's an art. Like, talking to your kids about not using is an art form. You can't hammer them too hard, because they're going to run the other way and they're going to find some people who will reinforce using. So if you push them too hard, you're going to push them the other way. If you don't push enough, then they're going to think everything's okay. You got to try to find something in
the middle. Well, the reality of it is, and I don't know how many people are aware of this, because you got to get your young people to talk to you, and you got to get them in a place where they feel safe to be open and honest with you. But they are all, or almost the majority of them, are at least smoking weed. Our kids had a hard time finding people to spend time with that weren't at least smoking weed. So, and they know people, most of the people they know are taking pills. So they're in a minority if they're not using.
So we need to be very, very aware and move forward. Well, we're coming to the end of our time here. And so do you have any final words of wisdom or any final pieces of advice for anyone out there who might be dealing with somebody who's in active addiction?
I would say it doesn't matter what you call it. First of all, if you're unhappy, and it's as a result of some type of substance that the other person is using, then it's a problem. And you don't even need to get into whether or not it's called addiction. It really doesn't matter. It's a problem. And the best place to start is to get educated on it. I wish I had done more of that earlier on, but I don't know that there was as much available. So get educated, start talking to some people that you feel confident, maybe that are knowledgeable about it. Don't be afraid, set your limits.
That's very good. And you did a great job on this podcast, and you've been a trooper through this whole thing. You've been part of the mission. I know that moving to the Carolinas from Pennsylvania has not been easy. The culture here and kind of fitting into this whole process is not an easy thing to do, but you've been willing to be part of that. And I appreciate
it's been
that
an adventure, and South Carolina has been wonderful to us. So
we will continue this journey, and we'll continue this fight, and we will continue on the Recovery Cartel. Next week, I'm going to bring in Chris Freeman and talk a little bit about what it's like in the social media marketing world and try to give you some information behind the scenes regarding that process. And again, we believe over time, the cartel is going to prove itself to be the one source of independent, objective information. Again, this is not about drinking the Kool-Aid. This is not about, it's not about just towing the company line. We're not looking for that. We don't need to hear any more about that. We've heard that for 40 years and we've seen the results, record-setting death. This is new ideas, new approaches, innovation. And innovation is not adding an equine therapist to your existing 12-step oriented rehab. That is not innovation. Innovation is brand new, cutting edge, never before thought of approaches, flipping the paradigm on its head. Melissa, thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Thank you for following the rules here on the cartel. And everybody out there, we'll see you again next week. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us today on the Recovery Cartel. For more information, check us out at therecoverycartel.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And again, join us next time. And remember, no matter what anybody says, there are multiple pathways to recovery. And the main thing is persevere. Don't give up.